This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. Today, our first witness who is doing a PowerPoint happens to be in New York, and there was something going on with airplanes that aren't flying today. So we're doing something that's even riskier for somebody who doesn't like to do PowerPoints, because how many things go wrong technically. He's doing a phone-in PowerPoint. So we have the PowerPoints here, and he's going to be connecting with us by phone, and we will hope that both the phone and the PowerPoint work. But a couple of years ago, we had somebody from Bloomberg here talking about energy financing, and it was, I think, very interesting. It was for the Legislative Energy Commission, not this committee, I think, but it was interesting, and because of all the changes and everything else, we thought it would be interesting to ask somebody from Bloomberg again this year. And Mr. Nick Culver from Bloomberg New Energy Finance Division was going to be here in person, but he's going to try and do this by phone with us operating the PowerPoint here. And with that, Mr. Culver, I hope you're here. And can you hear us?
Yes, sir, I can hear you. Hey, fine.
And we can hear you fine as well. So welcome to the Minnesota Senate Environment and Energy Committee. We have better weather than you do, actually, I think, today. Welcome, and please go ahead.
Great. Thank you for that introduction. And good afternoon to everyone. My name is Nick Culver. I'm the lead solar analyst for North America at Bloomberg Energy Finance. And, you know, thank you for inviting me. And I apologize if I have to do this by phone. My hope is that the slides that we've shared with everyone will be helpful. Basically, what they showcase is the most recent research that we've done. And this is data that's usually only available to our paid clients. And it's the product of, a large team of analysts that is based here in New York City. And not to turn this into a weather report, but I will mention that actually the snow was much less than the 2 feet that we expected in the city. So everyone's actually in pretty good shape. We have power, transit is restarting, other areas going to be getting more snow, but fortunately, I can safely move on to the presentation today. and I'll be calling out the slides. The agenda on slide one, basically I've split the presentation into three parts. Hopefully, they'll all go pretty quickly. The first part is looking at some of our broad data sets that I think are important to run through a little bit because they put the later parts of the agenda on the cost of solar and the cost of wind into context. That's what we'll be starting. We'll be looking at some broad numbers about the U.S. power sector, touching on natural gas as well. And then the end, basically a roundup. I don't have any slides for that, but I'll just mention a couple of the key takeaways, and then, if it's sufficient, we can get on to some questions as well.
Thank you. And before you continue, Mr. Culver, I wanted to tell folks here in the audience, if they can't see the PowerPoints well, that the committee has posted all of the PowerPoint slides online for public access, so people who have internet access here can see them if you can't see the screen well. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, and after the presentation, I can also answer questions by email, or if we can find an efficient way to do sort of follow-up, I'm happy to do that, because I know it can be challenging since I'm not there. Let's get started. One last time, I'm part of a research group called Bloomberg New Energy Finance. We're a global provider of news data and analytical tools focused on changing and sort of transitioning energy markets. So let's get started on slide two. And what you're looking at here is, basically the bread and butter of our company. We track financial investment into renewable energy. And this is usually the place that we start just because it sort of answers the question, how big are these clean energy markets? These are U.S. figures. Basically, we've gone from a $10 billion market in 2004 to about a $50 billion market. That's down from the peak in 2011, but obviously it's a growing market. And one thing we always point out is that we've actually seen a lot of cost declines in solar and wind during this period. So 50 $1 billion of investment gets you a heck of a lot more solar and wind than actually $65 billion did in 2011. And moving on to slide three, I'm going to be moving through some of these initial slides quickly since they sort of set the stage here. Slide three shows renewable energy build, and this is where sort of we start to make the distinctions between solar and wind. Wind is a more established technology. It's been, you know, a pretty big market since actually before 2008. But you sort of see that, solar has come on pretty strong. 2014 was the biggest year for solar of all time in the U.S., greater than 40% growth year over year to 2013. And you can sort of tell that story going back. You know, there's been serious growth every year. With wind, you know, it's a more mature technology, and the reason that you see kind of these ups and downs, most notably, you know, the banner year in 2012 and then the decline in 2013, is that the federal subsidy that primarily drives wind currently, which is called the production tax credit, has expired and been renewed multiple times by different Congresses. So, you know, unfortunately, we haven't found a way federally to sunset subsidies very efficiently in the wind market. That leads to sort of these booms and busts. On slide four, now we're sort of really starting to draw back a little bit before we narrow back in on wind and solar. Slide four, we can see that, you know, initially in 2008, you know, on the graph at the left, you know, new renewables were actually a good degree smaller than what we would call old renewables, which is mostly hydropower. But now in 2014, we've essentially achieved, essentially new renewables is now about equal to the amount of capacity that we have for hydropower. And unlike the figures that you saw on the last slide, which were annual build, slide four has cumulative build for wind and solar on the right. So you can sort of see that, you know, I'm a solar guy. I'm a solar analyst. Solar had a big year, but wind is still, you know, a much bigger industry in the U.S. currently. And now we're going to draw back even wider, and actually not going to draw back any wider than this. This is the U.S. power sector. And, you know, broadly speaking, the U.S. power sector is a game of four players. Over the past 7 years, 2007 to now, natural gas and renewables have been the big gainers. So natural gas used to provide 22% of our mix, now it's 27%. Renewables is 8%, now it's 13%. So those are both huge gains in a sector that sees change very slowly. Meanwhile, coal has been basically a loser. It provided half the generation for the U.S. in 2007, now it's down to less than 40%. And nuclear energy, or, you know, we call them nukes for short, are holding steady over this period. What is sort of the broad theme when you look at this? I think, you know, it has to be that the U.S. power sector is decarbonizing. You know, and part of that's the move from coal to gas. You know, usually we refer to natural gas as just gas. And it's also due to sort of the onset of new renewables as well. So the next couple slides, we're going to talk about natural gas for really turning to those renewable energy technologies. And natural gas is really super important when we're talking about a decarbonizing power sector. And we'll see that sort of natural gas, it's sort of the focal point when you're talking about the future of coal. It's also a focal point when you're talking about the future of renewables as well, at least from an economic perspective. And by the way, we're sort of, in this presentation, sticking to really talking about costs, talking about economics, and we're not going to talk too much about, you know, environmental externalities, environmental impacts, even though those things are incredibly important. They're not necessarily the focus of our research. So moving down to slide six, I want to show, you know, one reason that we've seen such a decline for coal is that coal plants are shutting down. This is not due to the EPA Clean Power Plan that has recently been rolled out to regulate carbon. This is due to regulations surrounding the more traditional emissions of coal, sulfur, nitrogen, mercury. As it says on the slide, the majority of these announced are for 2015, which is when a new major rule on new mercury takes effect. So, this is an important context to have. And if we scroll to slide 7, we can sort of take away another important piece of, the U.S. power story, and that's the fact that we have natural gas going head-to-head with coal in a big way on a price perspective. So, on slide 5, we saw that actually natural gas had a huge year in 2012. Basically, it jumped in a single year from 25% to 31% of the electricity mix, which is, for the U.S. power sector, a monstrous change. And on slide 7, you can see what happened. Basically, the price of gas broke out in terms of its competition with coal and became the cheaper resource for a short period of time. And, we can attribute this essentially to the shale boom, which caused a huge, massive glut of gas in the market. What's happened since then is that we've had the power sector gobble up a lot of that glut of gas. And, with sort of oversupply easing a little bit due to all the natural gas burn in the power sector, now we sort of see natural gas prices coming up and, achieving more of a parity with coal. So, although natural gas took a nice chunk of the market away from coal, some of those gains have been giving up, and we sort of have to realize that natural gas isn't going to compete coal out of existence. I think a more accurate way to describe it is that these two technologies compete fiercely with each other, particularly in deregulated markets where it's all about your marginal costs of generation. So without outside intervention, and certainly there are many outside interventions, but without outside intervention, there'll be no knockout blows in this sort of coal versus gas game for many years to come. And we're on to sort of our final two slides of the first segment of the presentation. We're on slide 8. This is important to show because it's our forecast, our most recent forecast, for natural gas prices, as shown by the Henry Hub. And we usually talk about natural gas prices in terms of fuel price, which is measured in dollars per MMBTU. And I'll mention that gas is at historic lows when it comes to price. We had prices of between $6 and $14 for MMBTU during 2004-2008. So in some cases, essentially prices that are off this graph. And, granted, places like New England, maybe parts of the Midwest don't have gas nearly this cheap during winter due to pipeline constraints. But by and large, the U.S. story is a cheap gas story, at least, if we're talking about the past 5 years. And as we mentioned, cheap gas is a bit of a double-edged sword for the progress of decarbonization in the U.S. sector. It helps for coal to gas switching. It makes it, cheaper, sort of move away from coal, but it also makes it tougher for solar wind to compete. Because, if gas is cheaper than solar and wind, then solar and wind are sort of relying on subsidies to sort of keep their momentum. And one of the major reasons that we'll sort of see this later in the presentation, other parts of the world have installed more solar, and generally more renewables than the U.S. is partially to be explained because they can't access natural gas nearly as cheap as the U.S. can. And I don't want to spend too much longer on this slide, but I also want to mention that although we're basically showing another decade of cheap gas, right? The uncertainty around this forecast is pretty huge, and I'm sort of taking these conclusions right from our natural gas team, which looks at this stuff every day, and they can easily concoct scenarios where natural gas actually becomes very expensive. possibly due to chronically overestimated reserves, which are themselves pretty uncertain. But also, it could be vulnerable to shocks as well. For instance, we ran a scenario where a single state, Pennsylvania, a single state banned fracking. And, it seems sort of far-fetched, but it might not be out of the question if, for instance, we have some type of weather event combined with a major environmental disaster, around fracking. And I'm, not an expert, not going to be able to comment on the likelihood of that, but even just the loss of those reserves in that single state, would make gas prices much more expensive very quickly. So there's definitely a decent amount of risk involved in these forecasts, and so I want to highlight that. And the most significant story in energy right now is oil prices. Right, we've had oil prices essentially fallen to half. I want to maybe come back to this later, but in general, the oil price story changes things on the margin for natural gas prices, and that's for sort of obscure reasons surrounding LNG exports. But in general, price of oil does not have super significant impacts on, our forecasts for things like the cost of solar, things like the cost of wind, or even, natural gas prices. It's simply not a major player in the power market. And, of course, everything will be cheaper. So if you're building, a wind site, then, the transport of the turbines to the site, there's many things that you can talk about around the edges. But the oil price story is actually not a huge deal for a lot of the issues we're talking about. And on slide 9, we're closing out the first section here. And I want to show this because whenever we're comparing the economics of different power generation technologies, we need to use a metric called levelized cost of energy, just because otherwise we'll be comparing natural gas fuel prices to the cost of solar panels. That won't be a one-to-one. So we call it LCOE, and the thing to take away from this slide is cheap gas brings you to an LCOE of, something around 30, 40, 50 when it comes to dollars per megawatt hour. So it's really what we're getting down to, the price of generating electricity. So if we're talking about when will renewables be cheaper than anything else available, then, usually we're talking about getting to that natural gas price, which is, 30, 40, 50, depending on, like we said, where the fuel price is, which is why it kind of ranges across the x-axis. So I hope everyone's still with me and can hear me well as we move on to the solar section.
Yes, the volume and everything's working well. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, good to hear. So moving on to solar before we get to wind and wrap up. I want to sort of start by showing who's selling it. Most solar modules, solar panel, solar module, same thing. Most of them are made in China, as you can see on the graph to the left. However, this sort of obscures the fact that the U.S. is actually a leading producer of polysilicon, which is the key raw material that is used to create solar panels. So, this sort of obscures a little bit of the fact that the U.S. actually has a pretty significant manufacturing stake in the solar sector. It's just upstream of the modules themselves. And if you want to get a sense of how big that is, the U.S. sells more polysilicon on a value basis than it actually buys in solar panels. Right? Because China is producing all these and selling them to the world. Whereas we can see on the right, this is basically who's building solar. The U.S. is a pretty small player, historically and even today, in the solar market. So in 2009, 2010, 2011, even 2012, it was really a European story. We had, Germany with a very strong feed-in tariff, Italy, same thing. And what we've seen now is that the market's moving to much greater reliance on Japan and China when it comes to purchasing solar. China's got a voracious demand for power. Japan's moving aggressively into solar for a number of reasons. They want to reduce reliance on nukes. And they want to reduce reliance on expensive natural gas imports. And meanwhile, the U.S. is the third largest market for solar. So if we look at slide 12. This is where, I'm sure you see articles every day, and you don't even click them anymore. You know, the cost of solar is climbing. And, this is sort of what we're talking about when, this gets reported on, is we're talking about the price of solar panels, solar modules. And, on the left axis, you see essentially dollars per watt is how we measure the cost of solar. And we were at $10 a watt in the 80s, and we've pretty much proceeded according to this model. And I won't explain it too much, but essentially how it works is that you double the amount of solar panels that you're producing on the supply side, then you reduce your cost by a set amount. So similar to the cost reductions in other technology industries, or rather every technology sort of has their own level of cost reduction, right? But for solar, it's been pretty consistent, as you can see, almost following the purple line. And so now we have, essentially solar panels being manufactured for about 50 cents a watt, whereas, that's from $10 a watt in the 80s and, $1 a watt just a few years ago. So there's been dramatic cost declines. And we're actually below 50 cents a watt, according to some of the Chinese companies that have filed in the last couple quarters. Or, we're actually 48 cents a watt. So it's incredibly cheap versus historically. And solar panel costs have fallen so much that they actually no longer make up a huge portion of the cost of installing a residential system. So on slide 13, this is a cool slide just because this is essentially coming directly from, surveys that we've done in the past 2 months. And the goal of those surveys was to understand the line item costs of solar. So we were interviewing EPC players, which is, people that build solar, stands for engineering, procurement, construction. We were interviewing financiers and basically asking, what are you paying for labor? What are you paying for design? What are you paying for all these pieces that go into solar? And as you can see, equipment's not a huge part of the entire cost. That's sort of the first thing to take away. The other thing to take away is that we have some regional differentiation. We only included 5 states in our survey, but we found that it really mattered where you were. And it had to do with not the solar sector, but the labor market. So, what is the dollars per hour that you need to pay laborers? What do you have to pay electricians? What are the fringe benefits you have to pay if you're unionized? North Carolina, labor's quite cheap. That probably is reflected of states like Texas and Arizona. And we sort of feel Massachusetts reflective of New England. So we can sort of say, use these states as a bellwether. Hawaii is a little bit of an outlier. It's not so much the labor is expensive, but rather, everything takes forever in Hawaii. this is pretty obvious, but you sort of have to build, we're sort of building the cost structure here from left to right. So if you want the total cost of solar right now, you sort of have to look at the top of the graph all the way to the right. So as you can see, we're saying that after you include all the fees, all the profits, acquisition costs, permitting costs, all these things, interconnection, then with residential, we've gotten down to about $3 a watt, which is not just cost, that includes profits and pretty much it's what we would call all in, $3 a watt. And if we go to the next slide, this is residential in Southern California. And we can sort of get a really true picture of, how the costs have changed. Because we can't just look at the panels. I guess that's what I would say in terms of getting past the news of cheap solar panels, is how much has the whole thing changed? And really it's fallen in half if we're talking about solar for about $3 a watt. It's really fallen in half in the last 3 years. think that's a fair way to explain it. And a lot of that has come out of equipment costs. So the name of the game now, I think for U.S. Solar, is to reduce the cost outside of equipment. So the cost of the builder, the cost of development, these are the things that the U.S. solar sector is focused on. And slide 15 shows at least one result of this, you know, dramatically cheaper solar. It basically, in 2011, had all California residential PV subsidized. And now, last year, we have less than 20% of the market was subsidized. CSI stands for the California Solar Initiative, which for a while was funding and subsidizing these projects. And now the CSI program has essentially been discontinued because it's not needed. So let's be clear, these projects are still getting some federal subsidies, but you know, California, and there's many states that will follow pretty soon, is no longer needing to provide state subsidies for solar. And on slide 16, the same thing as before, now we're just talking about utility scale. So, you know, 10 megawatt ground mount, that's something on the order of, 50 acres of solar being put up. And in this case, equipment is a huge part of the cost, just because the builder and the development, that those costs sort of are, achieve pretty good economies of scale for utility scale plants. They can't achieve for residential plants. And by the way, let me just give you one more comparable for residential from slide 13. You know, that 5 kilowatt rooftop that we did was $3 a watt. You know, for a normal home, that would be about $15,000 for a 5 kilowatt. But I just wanted to provide that as a marker. And then slide 17, we can see the same thing as before, except this time for utility scale. So, you can see it's much flatter. There's utility scale sector is just more efficient. And it's already reduced costs pretty substantially on the equipment side. Residential has more of a challenge in cost savings than utility sector is one thing to take away. The other thing to take away is that utility scale is simply going to be cheaper on an ongoing basis, getting down to as low as $1 a watt in the 2020s. And this is North Carolina, by the way. So we're in the home stretch for solar. On slide 18, I just wanted to share this mostly for the record. And so everyone here knows our forecast for solar bills in the next few years. And this helps you get a sense for the overall U.S. picture in terms of what people are building. Residential is the fastest growing segment, but it's still smaller than utility scale. Non-residential, that would be commercial solar, government, not-profit. That's a segment that's fairly small and not growing as quickly as residential. And then we have utility scale, which is the fastest growing segment. Sorry, not the fastest growing, but it's the largest segment and will continue to be. The step down from 2016 to 2017, that's sort of due to the expiration of the investment tax credit for solar, which is scheduled to be reduced from 30% to 10%. And we think that it's actually the small-scale solar that survives that, or even prospers in the case of residential, whereas the utility-scale economics are just, sort of a little more difficult around the expiration of that federal tax credit. And then on the right, you see cumulative solar bills in the U.S. as well. Slide 19 I wanted to show just because, I know Minnesota might be interested in sort of comparing, certain solar targets that you might have versus other states. And what we did is we took our solar forecasts and we said, if these states meet our forecast for what they're going to build, then here's where they'll be in terms of solar PV as a share of their total electricity use, so total retail sales. Hawaii leading the way. California is, even more impressive just given the size pure size of that market, that they'll reach 10% within the next few years. It's almost certain. And then there's a sort of a smattering of states that reflect, you know, in some cases good irradiation, but in other cases it more reflect just pretty aggressive state policy when it comes to, you know, driving solar. Like, you know, Massachusetts, Vermont, these are states that have pretty high electricity prices, so they're very interested in diversifying their electricity mix, and they're doing it aggressively. On slide 20, this is our quote, you know, this is our LCOE analysis for solar. So again, if we're putting solar straight up against another technology, this is what we would use. We're looking at all the market segments, utility scale, non-residential, and residential for North Carolina, and we're turning that into a levelized cost. So you can sort of see that utility scale, we think, will continue to be the cheapest form of solar electricity. There's a lot of nuance around, you know, what is the value of rooftop solar versus utility scale solar? Because rooftop solar can be closer to the source. It can have benefits that utility scale can't provide. So I want to be clear that LCOE is very important. And as we said, natural gas is in that 30, 40, 50 range in terms of its cost. You know, you want to get, you know, you want to sort of match that at some point. But again, natural gas prices could be much higher in these future years as well. And we have to think about, you know, the value. So solar is generating during the day. You know, there's good arguments that, you know, even if the cost is a little higher, the value might be higher as well. And I think that's the conversation that's happening in Minnesota right now. So we'll move on to the wind. I don't know how I'm doing on time, but I'll try to wrap up pretty quickly.
You're doing well. Keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, so for slide 22, this expands on what I was talking about before in terms of a little bit of the boom and bust nature of the wind sector. And we've rebounded from the 2013 bill, a year where really there was no wind bill. And it'll sort of happen again. I have my forecast later. In 2016, there's going to be another surge bill. And, you know, the wind sector is bigger than solar. It's, you know, very competitive on a, you know, on a cost basis, according to a lot of the PPAs that have been signed. So I think I mentioned those a little bit in the text here. You know, it, essentially, when you can get that production tax credit, which is part of the, part of the subsidy regime, wind can pretty much outcompete anything in the market, and that's why we saw such a big market. So the challenge for wind is sort of dealing with the end of the production tax credit. And so let's get into that a little bit. Slide 23 shows the cost of wind in select states, and this gives the incentive development costs, really. You know, it's no surprise that it's harder to develop outside of the contiguous United States. Minnesota is one of the cheaper places to develop, and it's the home of a few major construction companies as well on the renewable energy front. So no big surprise here. Slide 24, this is where you can sort of see the impact of the production tax credit on wind economics. And it's most dramatic in the states where wind is just naturally such a promising and strong resource. So, you know, on the left side of this graph on slide 24, you know, this is levelized cost dollars per megawatt hour. States in the southeast, areas that really have very poor wind resource, you know, if they didn't get the PTC, then they would be looking at that red line for costs right now. And really, that's not particularly competitive, especially in the southeast where coal tends to dominate and resulted in fairly low electricity costs. However, once we look at some of the best wind states in the United States, so Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Texas, this is where you can sort of see that with the PTC, those purple lines are all the way down to 20, $25 per megawatt hour, and that's essentially the cheapest electricity that you can get from any new resource. You know, you can out-compete natural gas all day at those prices. If we didn't have any production tax credit, you'd be back up at the red line. So, you know, in fact, you know, it's still a pretty competitive proposition, but, you know, obviously not as compelling as sort of these, you know, rock-bottom prices that we see. And I'll sort of close things up with slide 25, and here we're looking at our wind build forecast. And, you know, hopefully we're not, you know, overly bearish, but we sort of think that if this is sort of under a scenario where there is no production tax credit expansion, we think it'll slow down the wind market quite a bit. We'll have a big year in 2016. This year will be pretty good, too. But again, you know, without the production tax credit, these early years, 2017, 2018, 2019, this will be wind build that's economic in areas where the wind is good and power prices aren't too low. So I think, you know, wind will continue to be sort of a strong resource, but it'll be more focused on, you know, where the economics are the very best. Whereas, you know, in some of these previous years, we just had a lot of wind in a lot of places without the production tax credit. So, you know, the roundup, there's no slides for this. I think big takeaways from this presentation, hopefully, is that, you know, the power sector should be decarbonizing. We're following it very closely. It's very complicated. But I think that's sort of if we had to put one word on it, that's what it would be. Two, renewable energy is, you know, increasingly cost competitive, but it's also variably cost competitive. It's much better in some states than others. And then number three, natural gas prices, very low. We expect them to stay low, potentially for another decade. But really no one knows, you know, exactly where it'll be. And certainly there's sort of, you know, if we were surprised by the polar vortex in 2014. You know, there's many things that can sort of throw off the forecast on the fossil fuel front. On the other hand, you know, the solar forecasts for cost and the wind stuff, you know, I think that's sort of a volatility argument there, that it's tough to see cost going up in the renewable sector versus natural gas. So we sort of have to balance the costs and the implied volatility when we think about those technologies. So with that, I'll close. I look forward to any questions. I hope this was helpful. And thanks, everyone, again. Appreciate the invitation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Culver. And before we open up for questions, I'll just tell the members of the committee who came in that, in addition to this, he said he'd be willing to try and answer questions later. Maybe the committee can send contact information, or you can contact Barb and she will pass it on to him. And for those in the audience who didn't hear, these slides are all on our committee webpage as well. Questions from the committee? A lot of information. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the very last slide, number 25. When does that the federal production tax credit have to be secured for development to be ongoing in 2017, 2018, and ongoing? When do they need to know that there is going to be a tax credit?
Mr. Culver?
Sure. Yeah, so this is a little bit of a techie situation. The United States Congress extended the PTC to the end of 2014. So, in fact, it was a strange extension because the extension was only for 2 weeks after the lame duck session. However, it applies to any project that has, quote, begun construction. And when you dig into the technicalities of that, essentially what it means is that you need to complete by 2016. That's essentially what they mean. There's certain steps that you need to take. You need to, you know, sort of prove that you've spent a certain amount of money. If it's passed a certain date, and actually there's some uncertainty of what that date is. I think it's the end of 2015, as of now it might become the end of 2016. If you build before that date, then they don't even look at whether, you know, you've sort of been constructing the whole time. Whereas if you sort of complete construction in 2016 or 2017, then you have to go back and prove that you've been building the whole time. So it's kind of this, you know, a nebulous extension when it comes to when these projects will be built. But suffice to say that most of that 2016 build will be getting the production tax credit.
So, in other words, but if it's to continue to affect things in 2017, 2018, when she wants to know when Congress would have to act in order for that to change for 2017 and so on.
Well, I mean, as we saw, the extension in 2013 didn't really revive bill in 2013, right? So basically what happened is in 2012, it expired, and 2013, it was extended again. So I think if we truly did have a period where there was no production tax credit, then there would be a delay before extension would sort of revive build in the market. So I would say it would have to be the next couple of years to keep build numbers as high in 2017 and 2018.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Culver, on slide 18 and 20, does that explain the dip in the annual 2017 solar expansion and then the levelized cost of electricity as far as the PTC and no certainty for that market to expand? Is that why you're seeing the big dips?
So when it comes to slide 18, the solar sector relies on a different critical investment tax credit, which expires at the end of 2016, and we think that it's going to be responsible for a boom in 2016. So some of that build in 2016 would have happened in 2017. I'm sure if you ask some of the utilities, you know, Minnesota or, you know, in other states, if you're sort of planning to put up a bunch of solar, then, you know, you'd sort of be a fool to do it in 2017 when you could finish construction in 2016. So, and actually, it's sort of also building on the 2015 numbers as well. It's sort of trying to get, you know, optimize your federal incentives.
Yeah, okay.
So hopefully I understood the question. I couldn't hear it quite as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Culver, if you could explain slide 20 on the levelized cost of electricity for 2016 for solar, that dip and then the rise again. Can you just explain that again? Why?
Yeah. I apologize. Yeah,
oh, that's fine.
Perfect question. Something I should have explained before. That rise is due to the investment tax credit.
Yes, okay.
So, in fact, up to 2016, we're talking about the economics of solar after federal subsidies, in terms of the ITC and depreciation subsidies as well. So that is why you see that boost. And the ITC going from 30% to 10% sort of puts economics back several years when it comes to PV.
Thank you.
Further question. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you regarding how you're determining the cost of solar. I've noticed here you've got a lot of comparisons for North Carolina, South Carolina, Hawaii, Arizona, California. We have a nasty thing here during 4 months out of the year called winter, and the energy that actually is in sunlight is we generally don't get as much. When you're determining costs, should we be expecting a higher cost because we don't have the same kinetic energy within the sunlight that gets to us, or we have reduced sunlight hours? Would it be a fairly significant difference, or what type of difference would we expect here in Minnesota for actual results?
Right. So, great point. Irradiance can vary up to two times in the United States, at least in the contiguous United States. In other words, generally a rule of thumb is that the best solar is twice as good as the worst solar. That's very, very location dependent, not only the between states, but also within states, can be, you know, dramatically different. So, for instance, you know, I've seen sort of a lot of quotes that, you know, Minnesota gets irradiance constantly on the order of East Texas, and I think that's true. I think both of those locations are better than some of the states that that I mentioned. So, you know, Massachusetts, for instance, New Jersey. But you also have to look at, you know, where in these big states, you sort of have to, it's a little bit location dependent. So West Texas, I would say, has much better sun than East Texas. But all that said, I think, you know, when it comes to slide 20, I think that, and, you know, I'll make sure that, you know, I'm correct about this, but on a capacity factor basis, the better parts of Minnesota for solar PV are not all that different than North Carolina. Obviously, you'll lose a little bit, but it's really not a dramatic difference, even, as you mentioned, though, certainly there are months where you have snow cover. I mean, you have that in Massachusetts and Jersey, too, maybe not to quite as much of an extent. But this is already incorporated into sort of the capacity factors that we're using and everyone's using for these solar forecasts. And it comes from data that, weather data that's put together by NREL. So I would say Minnesota, even though it's sort of a very snowy state, it's, you know, much better irradiance than Maine, for instance. You sort of have to look at the irradiance map to get a sense of really what areas are better than others, and it's not always intuitive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please don't use the S word. We're not getting it. You can have it. We don't want it. One follow-up question to slide number 20. You've got this extended out through the year 2030. Obviously, PV that goes in today is going to be much more efficient and much more effective than the same PV in 2030 as its life expectancy comes to an end and decreases its ability to output from the panels. Does your calculations there take into account the less effectiveness of solar panels as they become older and older in the projects?
Sure. Thanks for the question. So the best way to read slide 20 is that each year is a whole new project, and it's looking at the lifetime of that project. So if you build a utility-scale plant in 2018, we're saying that the lifetime cost of that energy will be around $100 per megawatt hour. And that number includes degradation, assuming 0.5% of degradation per year. So, I mean, we can run the math of 0.5% of degradation out to 2030. Certainly that would be, you know, not full generation versus the first year of the system, but that's incorporated into each sort of year in that graph, if that makes sense. Does that make sense? I want to make sure being clear enough.
I think that was understood. So in other words, whatever the price in 2018, that's the levelized cost, is what that's going to be for the life of the panel. Question.
The life of a system that's built in 2018.
Right.
And then in 2020, that's the lifetime price of a system that's built in 2020.
When you were saying earlier that, I mean, the projections for natural gas is very hard to predict, and obviously you factor in what's happening with investment tax credit and so on, do you ever factor in the chance that either investment tax credit or production tax credit for wind would be extended further? And if so, what does that do to numbers here? Obviously it changes them, but is the estimate in analysis land that it's not going to happen, or is it that you factor it in but the chance is so low you can't bet on it one way or another?
Well, actually, in the case of the investment tax credit, the solar industry is pushing very hard for extension. And I think our house view is that they won't necessarily get it. And part of that view comes from the fact that we have states in the U.S. where solar is already competing without state subsidies. So We think that, you know, with continued cost declines in 2016, we'll face a situation where actually an extension of the 30% ITC could be considered overkill for, you know, California, for instance, and parts of the Southwest. So that's not a view that's universal. The solar industry is pushing hard for renewal. I think all you need to do is sort of follow those lines in slide 20 without the bump. And, you know, I know that's kind of hard to visualize, but you basically see solar being more cost competitive with the 30% ITC, no question. And I think that would certainly provide a boost to states where solar can't immediately compete against electricity prices.
For sure. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Scalzi.
Yes, I just have a question related to the degradation of the solar panels. Have you factored in the fact that some solar panels, and maybe not the Chinese type, may last longer? I know we have a company in Minnesota that claims to have panels that last longer than the ones made in China. Have you factored that in related to the cost of the solar?
Sure. So we have a financial background, and we sort of think about lifetime in terms of financial lifetime. And I know that's, you know, that some folks might consider that unfortunate, but the cost that we're showing assume that pretty much every solar array dies at year 20. Right? So as you mentioned, there's a good chance that a lot of these renewable energy project, not just solar, but especially solar, will be around for much longer than 20 years. Certainly, they'll need some parts replaced. You know, for instance, the inverter tends to need replacement every 10 years or so. But in general, I would sort of consider that upside for solar from our forecast. And in terms of quality, you know, the domestic companies versus Chinese, I think, you know, the jury's out a little bit. There's a lot of talk that, you know, the Chinese have achieved such low costs because, you know, the models that, you know, are being sold right now just aren't going to last as long as the ones that were sold a few years back. But, you know, it's sort of just talk at this point. I haven't seen any credible studies that have, you know, really proven the fact that these panels are going to degrade more than is expected. So, you know, maybe you pay more for a higher quality panel and you can sort of bet on it lasting 30, 40 years. I wouldn't discount that. But I think that, you know, pretty much, you know, the market is sort of, even the Chinese models that make up the bulk of the market that are exported to the U.S. Have, you know, a quality that can easily get you past that 20-year lifetime.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Culver, for your time and expertise, and we will be in touch with you if we have more questions along the way. A lot of information, short period of time. Thank you for doing it by phone since you couldn't be out here.
Thank you, everyone. Take care.
With that, we're going to move on to a clean energy economy profile report from Deed and welcome the two, Ms. Sternberg and Mr. Grant, in. And while they're coming up, I'll mention there are two other things in the packets that one was an article about wind development in southern Minnesota and the revenue that tax revenue that was coming in from it. The other one last week when we had the discussion of the 40 by 30 renewable energy standards study, that was on last Tuesday. And the following day, Union of Concerned Scientists put out a report, which is in the packets as well, that does talk about the costs, and their estimate is that, you know, they talk about other benefits like the one that Ms. Sternberg's going to be talking about, economic development and so on. Their estimate is on page 2 of that report that the net economic cost of to electricity would be about 0.2% increase between now and 2030, about 12 cents per month for a typical household, they say. Anyway, that report coincidentally came out the day after we had a lot of discussion of cost. That report is in there as well as that article on that. And Ms. Sternberg, are you ready to begin, or Mr. Grant, who's going first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, and we work closely with the Department of Employment and Economic Development on this study, and we're happy to present it to you today. And a great segue from the information that you were just receiving about trends in the renewable energy sector, the clean energy sector, at the national level, and we have some information for you that brings this down to the state level. Over the past year, we worked closely with each other and with a consultant to prepare this Minnesota Clean Energy Economy Profile. I believe you have copies of the report in your packets. This was part of an initiative from the National Governors Association. Minnesota was selected as one of four states to participate in what was called the Clean Energy Policy Academy, along with the states of Mississippi, Arizona, and Puerto Rico. Some of the key takeaways from the report are that the Minnesota's clean energy market is growing, and that growth has already helped decrease dependence on imported energy. And the energy policies that this body has been wise enough to support over the years has really helped establish Minnesota as a national leader and gives our state a competitive advantage in the clean economy sector going forward. Some of the contextual information that's important, I think, for people to understand before we get into the numbers in the report. Minnesota currently imports about $18 billion a year in fossil fuel expenditures from other states around the country. So that puts us presently as a strong net energy importer and has an impact on the state's economy, a clear impact on the state's economy. The global clean energy market, in the meantime, is estimated at over $1 trillion and growing rapidly. Some of the other things that we learned in preparing the report is that employment in the clean energy sector grew seven times faster than overall state employment during the last 15 years, that these jobs and wages in this sector are 40% higher than the state average, and that this is a sector where, as I mentioned before, Minnesota is a leader, not only in terms of the development of projects and renewable energy systems, but also in innovation with very strong patent and investment activity ongoing. So some of the examples of clean energy policies that you already are aware of, and these are just a couple, are the state's renewable energy standard and our energy savings goal for electric and natural gas utilities. And some of the comparisons that we can make for the policies that we have had in place is that, for example, with biofuels, we've managed with biofuel production to replace about 1.7 million vehicles for 1 year just with the biofuels that have been created and developed here in the state of Minnesota. On the electricity side, energy efficiency and renewable electricity have generated enough power to cover 1.4 million homes in the state for 1 year. So clearly, the capacity that we're developing in these areas is having a marked impact on the state's economy and on our energy sector. With that, I will turn the microphone over to Ms. Sternberg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Robin Sternberg from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm going to continue on with the presentation. This slide shows the clean energy employment growth that we have seen here in Minnesota over the past 14 years. Overall, Minnesota's clean energy employment has grown about 78%. And this is what we did in our study is we surveyed about a total of over 7,000 businesses, establishments, and our response, our total response was about 10% of that. So we have information from about 772 companies around the state that gives us a good representation of what we're finding to be clean energy jobs and wages in Minnesota. You'll see that over the course of those years, we have added about 7,000 jobs to our state's economy. And while our greatest number of jobs occur exist in the energy efficiency sector, what we've seen over time is a diversification of jobs that has expanded our the sectors of the bioenergy, wind, solar, and smart grid. Bio, solar, smart grid sectors have doubled in their number of jobs, and the wind jobs have quadrupled. We believe that this diversification is very good for our state because a broader energy platform, of course, helps reduce dependence on fossil fuel energy, but also on any one source of energy. It increases our resiliency and economic security, energy security, and it helps stabilize prices. As we know, we see a lot of volatility in prices, and that the broader our platform is of energy sources, the more stabilized our overall energy prices will be over time. I also want to add that these jobs that were surveyed are found across our entire state. The growth in jobs is significant in each region of our state. Metro area jobs grew 53%. Jobs in the southern part of our state grew 71%. In the southwest, jobs grew 425%. In the central region, they grew 191%. In the Northeast, 146%, West Central, 408%, and the Northwest is only 13%, but the other area is very significant. This
Mr.
slide...
Berg, is that regional breakdown, is that in the report? I mean, one of the pages?
Yes, in the back of the report, we show specific information on each of those seven regions, and those seven regions were identified as regions that... the Minnesota Initiative Foundations use for their areas, their identified regions. So they're not always, all the different regions are kind of have different boundaries depending on what you're looking at. But that's what we use for this study. This slide shows wages, the change in wages over that same period of time. Overall, the payroll for clean energy jobs increased from $600 million in 2000 to over $1 billion by 2014, and this is adjusted for inflation. Our average wage in the clean energy sector was found to be significantly higher than the average wage across Minnesota for all jobs. Average wages in clean energy are around $71,000. And the nice thing, too, about jobs in the clean energy sector is it provides jobs for college-educated workers as well as technicians and those with technical degrees as well. So good jobs across the board. And finally, as Bill mentioned, Minnesota is very strong in innovation around clean energy. We found that we rank eighth in clean energy in the country for energy patents in 2013, which is up from 20th where we were in 2003. So we've made a lot of strides in that decade in patents. Some of the more active companies with patents is listed on page 36. Companies you're familiar with, 3M, Emerson, and IBM are some of the leading companies developing these patents. The second part of the innovation analysis showed us that Minnesota ranks second in venture capital spending in the Midwest. And we found that there was about $400 million in venture capital spending in the last 10 years. So that's very positive. Again, I do encourage you to to look at the regional breakdown information that's in your packet, but we, you know, it's the report shows that for the seven regional areas in the state, that each region has different strengths and different opportunities for job growth. The Twin Cities Metro has 74% of energy efficiency jobs, for example. The Central Region has 31% of smart grid jobs. The Southern Region has 30% of Minnesota's bioenergy jobs, and the Southwest Region has 41% of Minnesota's wind power jobs. So the sector is really showing promise across all different types of clean energy technology, and again, speaks to that opportunity that Minnesota has to broaden, have a very broad energy platform. And so in conclusion, our report was very promising, and we're really excited about it. We feel that Minnesota's market has grown and is growing, but still offers a huge opportunity for our state. We are participating in a clean energy race, and through our project, we had a lot of interaction with other states who are pursuing clean energy as a competitive advantage. States such as New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and they're all after this clean, and other countries as well, are all after this clean energy $1.1 trillion market. Minnesota is definitely poised to capture that market share, some of that market share, if we continue to support these technologies and support those industries and support those companies with job training and financing and cluster support. However, you know, we do have a long way to go. One thing about the study that wasn't promising is that the companies did not report a lot of exports. Hardly any, in fact. It was so minimal that we didn't even put it, there was nothing really substantial to put in the report. So the more that we allow these companies and sectors to grow, we will reach that tipping point where we no longer will be an $18 billion importer of energy and hopefully a net exporter to capture some of that market share. That's it.
Ms. Sternberg, on that last point, you were saying, I understand the $18 billion versus imports versus exports. You were saying the technology is not being exported or the power is not being exported?
Neither.
Okay, and when you showed the numbers of patents and everything, mm-hmm. are you projecting that's changing or you're just saying it might change?
I'm sorry, the last part of your question?
The fact you say how many patents are coming from Minnesota, the list of the companies and mm-hmm. so on, is the fact that there's so many patents in recent years coming from here a sign in your mind that there is going to be a change in that, or you're just saying it's possible it will be?
Well, this would be my opinion, but I think there is a lot of energy around clean energy. We had roundtables with the five different sectors that were studied, and there just seems to be a very strong commitment to growing those industries amongst those companies. And so I would assume that there is will continue to be a commitment to developing technologies and patents. If you look at the University of Minnesota, they are doing more and more around this clean energy topic and working through their economic development department to help these companies grow. So I think I would say that we will see more growth in the patents.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my first question ties in with what Senator Marty just asked, but how much of the solar panels and wind turbines that are being used in Minnesota are manufactured here versus what's being imported from other states? Do you have a rough estimate on what that would be?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, we assemble a great deal of the solar panels being used here in Minnesota. We don't create the silicon wafers that are the chief component of the solar panels. Those are produced not in other states so much, but in other countries.
Okay. And, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Grant. Clean energy uses a lot of copper and nickel, of which we have a great abundance here in Minnesota. Can we foresee the day when we use the copper and nickel in Minnesota versus importing it from countries like Russia and China that are major polluters on the world? Wouldn't there seems to be a disconnect is what I'm getting at. Wouldn't it make sense to use our own copper and nickel in a state that's very environmentally friendly versus importing it from other nations that are major polluters in the world? Well, putting you on the spot.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I think the use of raw materials such as copper and nickel for the manufacturers of these products depend on world prices and a supply chain that is global. And to the extent that Minnesota competes in that world market, I expect that a share of what we build here will rely on Minnesota-developed products, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grant, that was well stated. Mr. Chair, I would like to point out that there is a huge disconnect here. Oftentimes the same people who are advocating for clean energy, which does use a fair amount of copper and nickel, are the same people who fight against using the copper and nickel that's available right here in Minnesota.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sternberg, we had a very good discussion about the investment tax credit for solar and the production tax credit for wind. Was that part of your analysis here, this profile, as far as ongoing? Was that part of the discussion and part of the equation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the study really looked at the jobs that were creating the economic impact, looking backwards, really analyzing.
Not going forward.
Or making recommendations for the future.
Okay. And Mr. Chair
Rosen.
Just to that discussion about being an exporter of wind or of energy, we did pass that bill last year, yes. And I do have a bill this year for no certificate of need for natural gas exporting. But it is a very good discussion to have. I guess, Ms. Sternberg, my question would be the $18 million that we are importing, what is the breakdown on that as far as what type of energy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I'm sorry I don't have that information. I'm happy to get that for you and send it to you.
I would like that. Yes, thank you. I appreciate
it. If you could send it, I think the whole committee may be interested in that.
Okay.
So, but that $18 billion is fuel costs and, I mean, whether it's electric costs or raw material, raw fuels coming in, that the combination of all that. That includes everything, including transportation,
yes.
Fuels, everything.
Yes, sir, it does.
Thank you. We'd like that information, yes. Other questions from the committee? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either of the testifiers, one of the projects that's listed here on page 38 of the report is Grand Meadow. And I want to ask you some questions about the gearboxes and the actual mechanics. I was provided some information. Actually, there's a report in the Post-Bulletin out of Austin talking about gearbox failures. And that actually Xcel Energy has had to put in a very expensive oiling devices to the tune of enough money that they're asking for rate increases. Can you expand upon maybe a little bit, if you have any additional information on gearbox failures and the ongoing repair costs that seem to be escalating and accelerating on some of these wind farms?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Osmick, I don't have that information with me here today. I could certainly try and get it for you, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would love to see a report on as many of the facilities that we have on ongoing maintenance, on how much these are costing us, what was expected to be the cost, what's the ongoing cost, and what are the unexpected costs that we are seeing out of wind farms, because there are reports out there that these costs are upwards of $360,000 to repair gearboxes, which obviously is going to impact the price of electricity that comes out of those facilities.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Senator Osmick, it's interesting to look at just refurbishing the old wind farms. At what point are they going to be putting in larger blades, quieter blades? Just that whole industry, too, we need to probably take a look at what point that investment will happen. And as far as setbacks, that will be affecting the setbacks if it's larger blades, bigger turbines, you know, that whole thing needs to be reviewed.
And on that, I guess, what is the life expectancy of a wind turbine in some of the older ones? I mean, what is the projection? I mean, how often is the turnover in turbines?
Mr. Chairman, of course, you know, Minnesota has been a pioneer in the wind industry, and even at that, though, most of the systems that have gone in only got started in the 1990s and into the 2000s, so we haven't yet seen the full lifetime of most of those projects, projected to last anywhere from 20 to 25 years, same way with a solar project. And as Senator Rosen mentioned, wind projects in some places likely will be repowered as they represent excellent wind sites when the equipment is at a point where new technology is sufficiently superior that it's economic to make that transition. Many companies will be doing that and seeking extensions to the contracts that they have with power companies.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. There's a small wind group that's actually gone bankrupt in my area that not necessarily from operations as much as from the federal government and FERC with some obscure requirement that they had for reporting that's resulted in fines that will force the company into bankruptcy and thereby require another federal company to pay out on loan guarantees, which is about as convoluted as the federal government is. But anyway, we also have had serious problems, particularly with some of the older and smaller generation equipment, with some of the serious ice storms we had 2 years ago, and that there has been an accelerated repair schedule and perhaps even replacement. And so, and as some of these, and obviously the generation has grown in terms of the generators themselves. And has there been, and I guess one question I do have for you, Mr. Grant, is in the overall scheme of things, as we look at the smaller systems getting to the end of their life expectancy, are they readily available to be upgraded to the larger generators? And has that been provided for in various reports?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Weber, as Ms. Sternberg mentioned, this report really only takes us up to the current time. We don't forecast the future in this study. With respect to facilities on the ground, I mean, I think those are going to be case by case decisions. In some cases, the towers that are in place will be adequate to repower in place, in effect. In other cases, the site is still very usable, but the equipment itself from the ground up would likely be replaced. So I think that's going to be on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, and that does bring up a good point about CBED, Community-Based Energy Development. I think it would be helpful for the committee to know how these projects are being funded now that I believe CBED is not being utilized as much, and just to have that historical aspect of CBED going forward. I don't know if that can happen now or maybe some future, but it was really important for many of the development in my Senate district, and now I understand that they're not utilizing it as much. So,
Mr. Grant, do you have any quick comments on that?
No, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen is absolutely right. Community-based energy development was a key part of the development phase that Minnesota went through, and my personal view is that there is still room for that type of financing. You're right. Larger events have kind of overtaken us, and financing is now available in a variety of other forms, and institutional investors have become much more involved in this marketplace and generally can find lower cost financing than can owners at the community scale. But I think it was an important part of our development and may be in the future as well.
Ms. Sternberg, one question about in the graph on the figure 17 where you talk about various regions, you can picture that the Twin Cities has most energy efficiency and Southwest the wind power. I was curious why the central region has so much of the smart grid jobs. Is that because we're so much of the generation?
Smarter.
I have a drum shot on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure exactly. Just most likely a cluster of companies who are developing parts for okay. smart grid.
The cluster of companies is not because where generation is or... Any other questions? With that, I appreciate your showing us this. It's nice to see the level of compensation. I'm curious how that breaks down between the professional and the installation and management, the $71,000 average. Is that?
I do, Mr. Chairman, I think I do believe we have that. I will certainly send it to you.
Okay, thank you. If you could,
average by
by type of profession.
By the professional, yes.
Whether engineers versus
yes.
Okay, thank you very much. And with that, this committee, no further business. This committee meeting is adjourned.
She's moving away.